Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week on the show, GPS jamming, how worried should Europe be? And pipeline wars, what the bombing of Russian oil infrastructure means for Hungary. Then we'll be taking a look ahead to next week's confidence vote in France. Could this be the end of François Bayrou's government? And also to general elections in Norway, where the country's sovereign wealth fund is once again at the centre of discussions. All those stories and more coming up here on Inside Europe. As we went to studio this week, European leaders were gathering in Paris for Coalition of the Willing talks aimed at finalising security guarantees for Ukraine. It seemed fitting then to begin with a security story. But security stories aren't just about battle lines and troops on the ground. Sometimes they're about something as intangible as a GPS signal. A GPS signal which gets jammed. One of the big security stories of the week has been the fallout from an incident last weekend when an EU Commission chartered plane on a tour of frontline states reportedly lost access to GPS signals while approaching a Bulgarian airport. Was it Russian jamming? If so, the target couldn't have been more high profile. On board the plane, EU Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen. Our security correspondent, Terry Schultz, has been looking into the issue of GPS interference, which has been a topic of long-standing concern, particularly for countries on Europe's eastern flank.
After European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen's plane was reportedly forced to delay its landing in Bulgaria due to sudden and suspicious navigation problems, it elevated complaints about this behavior that had long been building in Eastern European countries and the Baltic states. Arianna Podesta is a European Commission spokesperson.
We are, of course, aware and used to the threats and intimidations that are a regular component of Russia's hostile behavior.
The flight was able to land safely with the pilots using other means of navigation.
Moscow denies it had anything to do with the GPS interference.
But Podesta said the incident demonstrated the urgency of the mission von der Leyen was on, talking up EU defense capabilities in countries along the EU's eastern border.
There she has seen firsthand the everyday challenges of threats coming from Russia and its proxies. And of course, the EU will continue to invest into defense spending and in Europe's readiness even more after this incident.
There's been a huge increase in the number of times flight or ship navigation systems have been hindered by either jamming of the signals or spoofing, sending purposely inaccurate data that can endanger them. Anna-Kaisa Itkinen is the Commission's spokesperson on transportation matters.
There was a letter sent by 13 member states to the Commission in June this year, and they drew our attention additionally to this issue, which is something that is becoming almost a daily practice. It has serious impacts on maritime and aviation, and obviously with economic impacts as well.
Among the countries signing that letter she mentioned is Lithuania. Its air traffic control company said pilots reported 1,022 incidents of navigation interference in June alone, a more than 2,000% increase from a year earlier when there were 46. Vesela Chernova is the deputy director of the European Council on Foreign Relations based in Sofia, Bulgaria. She says this meddling with navigation can go much further.
Russia has the capability to interfere in our air traffic, in our controlling systems, in critical infrastructures, ports, but also hospitals and so on and so forth. So this is why this whole line of defense, the defense in cyber, is extremely difficult, and preparedness and resilience are two words that are more and more on the minds of governments in Europe.
Chernova says the fact this time the target was the very top of the European Commission should be a wake-up call to take the activity seriously.
I hope in the end it's going to produce a new policy that is going to contribute to the resilience of the countries, especially those here around the front line. And I'm not talking about simply about GPS jamming, you know, but about the plethora of possibilities for hybrid attacks that can really undermine citizens' security.
After the incident, Defense Commissioner Andreas Kubilius announced the bloc will deploy additional satellites to strengthen resilience against GPS interference and will also improve capabilities to detect the attacks. Kubilius happened to be on a plane with von der Leyen. While he was in office, former Lithuanian Foreign Minister Gabrielius Landsbergis tried to raise the alarm about these incidents and to raise the cost for Moscow. Landsbergis suggests things are not moving in the right direction, with Russia having just also damaged the EU diplomatic mission in Kyiv a few days ago.
Russians are getting bolder. The GPS jamming and an attack on EU representation in Kyiv show that EU strategy, hiding from Russia behind Ukrainian or American backs, is no longer viable. And if Europe is not ready to stand up, it will only get worse.
NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte says in the alliance, they are standing up against the interference.
I can assure you that we are working day and night to counter this, to prevent it, and to make sure that they will not do it again.
Never again may be an unrealistically high bar in a short time, but at least after the von der Leyen incident, it's the goal. Terry Schultz, DW, Brussels.
From satellite to energy infrastructure now. Tensions are running high between Hungary and Ukraine after Kyiv bombed a Russian oil pipeline, which Hungary depends on for a considerable amount of its energy needs. Now, yes, there is an EU embargo on Russian oil imports, and yes, Hungary is a member of the EU, but it obtained exemptions which have allowed it to continue and, in fact, deepen its reliance on Russian fossil fuels. As a result, infrastructure damage within Russia is of massive concern to Viktor Orban and the Hungarian government. I spoke to our Budapest correspondent Stefan Boss about the government's reaction.
Hungary has announced that a senior Ukrainian officer, his name is Robert Brovdy, also known as Magyar here, and basically what Hungary decided, that he will be barred from entering Hungary and the entire Schengen zone, which is the free travel area within many European countries. The interesting thing in this is that Brovdy is an ethnic Hungarian, so he belongs to the Hungarian minority in Ukraine, and he is also a Ukrainian citizen. And now he heads the Ukraine's unmanned systems forces and basically oversaw the recent attack on the Druzhba pipeline, which means, by the way, Druzhba means friendship pipeline, which supplies more than half of Hungary's oil imports. Now, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has condemned Hungary's decision to ban the officer who led these strikes, and he called it an outrageous attempt to shift blame for the war onto Ukraine.
It's no secret, Stefan, that Vladimir Zelensky and Viktor Orban are not exactly the best of buddies. But still, targeting a pipeline that was supplying over half of Hungary's oil needs, I mean, that's risky, isn't it? Because Hungary is still an EU member and as such can make life really quite difficult for Ukraine.
It's a very interesting question. I think, first of all, Ukraine has made it clear in general that it wants to ensure that Russia won't use energy revenues for its war effort. And of course, Russia is very much dependent on the revenues flowing from oil and natural gas. And that's why Ukraine is trying to stop that by targeting that infrastructure. However, President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine also suggested that the strikes were meant to pressure Hungary to support Ukraine's bid to join the European Union. This is what he said about that.
Ми завжди підтримували дружбу між Україною і Угорщиною. А тепер існування дружби залежить від позиції Угорщини.
Now, he's basically saying we have always supported the friendship between Ukraine and Hungary. Now, of course, he is referring to the pipeline. And he adds, and now the existence of friendship depends on the position of Hungary on EU membership. Now, those remarks led to an angry response from Hungary's foreign minister, Peter Szijjártó, who suggested that the Ukrainian president is behaving like the television comedian he once was before running for office.
Na most a barátság kőolajvezeték bombázása, rakétázása az nem Oroszországnak árt, hanem nekünk, magyaroknak.
So the foreign minister is now saying that the bombing and rocketing of the friendship oil pipeline is not damaging Russia, but us, Hungarians and Slovaks. And this is causing an uproar. It is disgusting. But this is what the Ukrainian president, a former actor, is doing. Now, and I can tell you also that the minister argued Ukraine knew the pipeline was vital for Hungary's and Slovakia's energy supply, and he warned that anyone threatening Hungary's energy security must expect consequences. Hungary has also made clear it will not be blackmailed and will use its veto to prevent Ukraine from ever joining the European Union. The government cites economic and security concerns, and it also claims that a state-organized public consultation in June showed about 95% of Hungarians who took part opposed Ukraine's EU accession. Now, Hungary, as well as Slovakia, which also suffers from Ukraine's attacks on Russian energy infrastructure, they both have asked the EU's executive body, the European Commission, to help them achieve energy security.
So how does the European Union stand then? Because, I mean, it's in a difficult position, isn't it? Because it's got to support Ukraine. But on the other hand, energy concerns within its member states are a real problem as well.
Yes, that's a very interesting point, because the European Commission, they have said that oil supply security have not yet been affected this time around due to stockpiled reserves. But they also stressed that critical infrastructure should be protected by all parties. And that was a clear reference to Ukraine as well. Now, I can tell you that tensions remain high between Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orbán, who is viewed increasingly as authoritarian by critics, and Brussels. Now, the EU leaders accuse his government of pursuing a pro-Moscow policy and say not enough has been done to diversify energy resources. And actually, Kiev is saying to the Hungarian Prime Minister, well, if you have complaints, complain to your friends in Moscow because they started the war. For now, oil is flowing again from Ukraine, but the question remains how long the friendship, in more than one sense, will last.
Our Budapest correspondent, Stefan Boss, there. That brings us to the end of our security section for this week. Next up, two reasons why September 8th is looming big on the European political calendar. That's here on Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock, in Bonn. September 8th was already down in our Inside Europe diary as the date of Norwegian national elections. More on that later. Then came French Prime Minister François Bayrou's potentially fateful decision to call a confidence vote in his government for that same day. It was, he said, the only way of resolving the gridlock surrounding his controversial budget plans aimed at reducing France's national debt. But, as John Laurenson reports from Paris, Bayrou's gamble looks likely to backfire. France has already had three different prime ministers over the past year. Is it about to lose another one?
C'est la raison pour laquelle j'ai demandé au président de la République de convoquer le Parlement.
There was, in François Bayrou's surprise announcement that he's putting the future of his government to a vote in Parliament, an echo of President Macron's surprise decision a year ago to call fresh parliamentary elections. Macron hoped he'd win renewed support from the people, but lost his relative majority in Parliament. Bayrou hoped he'd win a majority of deputies who, in his words, were ready to choose responsibility rather than chaos, in other words, back his controversial austerity budget plans. He knew the far-left ecologists and socialists would probably vote against him because they oppose his budget cuts. He apparently hoped the far-right Rassemblement National would support him. But if that was the case, he was soon disappointed.
Il n'y a qu'une seule possibilité pour sortir de cette impasse politique dans la
Rassemblement National number 2 Jordan Bardella said there was only one way to clear the current political roadblock, and that was fresh elections. It was Emmanuel Macron who got us into this situation, he said, so he must either dissolve parliament or resign as president so that people can choose a new direction for the country. The risk for the Rassemblement National is that voting down the Bayrou government will increase scepticism about their ability to manage the economy. François Bayrou has staked his premiership on the issue of the debt. His plan to reduce the budget by 44 billion euros by measures including, most remarkably, getting rid of two bank holidays, is aimed at getting France's 3.3 trillion euro debt under control. The Sorbonne University political philosopher Pierre-Henri Tavoyot saluted Bayrou's move for concentrating minds on the debt problem.
On a du mal en France à se mettre d'accord, pas simplement sur les mesures, mais sur...
Professor Tavoyot said it was difficult for the French not just to agree on the cures, but also the diagnosis. And the diagnosis, he said, was tragic. It is, he said, that because of the debt, France is losing its sovereignty, its ability to decide its own destiny in the world. Not in 10 years' time, but in a matter of months. The sense of Bayrou's no-confidence vote, and I think this is very intelligent, he said, is not to say, approve my measures, but let's agree on the gravity of the situation. Nevertheless, Bayrou's opponents on the left and far right are choosing not to understand it this way. They reject the plan he's putting forward. The socialists, for example, want a new wealth tax to pay for a lowering of the retirement age from 64 to 62. The Rassemblement National wants to reserve state benefits for French nationals to fund a lowering of the retirement age to 60. So, if Bayrou falls, what will happen next? The opinion polls say some 63% of the French want President Macron to dissolve Parliament again and call fresh elections. If he does that, other opinion polls show the Rassemblement National is way ahead of its adversaries at 33%. A coalition of the far-left, centre-left and ecologists coming second at 25%. However, if the Rassemblement National's adversaries form a so-called cordon sanitaire against it, as it did last time, it is unlikely that new elections would change the makeup of the National Assembly very much. That is the opinion of Socialist Party leader Olivier Faure, in any case, who is calling for a different solution.
J'entends parler de dissolution.
After confirming that there's no way his party would support the Prime Minister in the no-confidence vote, Faure said that dissolution would solve nothing, as it would probably just produce another hung parliament. So we best make do with the parliament we have now, he said. France is not ungovernable, just badly governed, he said. He called for a Prime Minister from the left. He didn't say so directly, but himself, for example, who would govern from the left, seeking out parliamentary majorities for each piece of legislation, but with the aim of putting a left-wing programme in place. Faure's plan, it seems, has the favour of President Macron. The President dissolved Parliament once and doesn't fancy doing it again, and at the same time he's ruled out resignation. However, if a left-wing government is formed in the coming weeks, that government could very well be very short-lived. It is now very likely that France will have a new Prime Minister this month. It is also likely it'll have yet another one by Christmas. How many would that make for this year? People are starting to lose count. John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
And you can bet your bottom euro that we will be returning to Paris next week after that vote. In the meantime, we have a preview of another big vote scheduled for September 8th, the Norwegian parliamentary elections. Now, political discourse in Norway is often rather different to that in other countries, in large part because whilst countries like France are worrying about where to save money, the debate in energy-rich Norway is usually about how to spend it. This election is no exception, with Norway's much-envied sovereign wealth fund at the heart of the political discussion. Here's Lars Bevanger with the details.
So, kommer det til å komme mest til gode, de rikeste som...
One of the final party leader debates before Norwegians head to the polls on the 7th and the 8th of September. Very simply put, the disagreements center on what pot of money should be spent on welfare services. Tax the rich, cut taxes to encourage growth, or spend more oil money. It is jokingly said that all of Norway's political parties are social democrats because they all support a strong welfare state, but they do disagree on how it should be funded. Labour and other parties on the left want to maintain relatively high taxes, while the Conservatives and the Populist Progress Party promise lower taxes, same welfare, counting on efficiency, private sector growth, and, in the case of the Progress Party, using more oil money while also trimming some welfare programs. Recently, the crux of the argument has been the so-called wealth tax, taxing assets like houses, shares and bank deposits. The left argues some of Norway's richest pay no or little income tax and should therefore pay tax on their wealth. The right says this pushes wealthy individuals to move abroad, which many have done. It is estimated that more than 100 Norwegian millionaires and billionaires now live in Switzerland. However, many Norwegian voters still have a strong sense of equality and don't like the idea of some people avoiding paying tax like normal people. Money, money, money. You'd have thought having 1.7 trillion euro in the bank should make governing Norway easy. Yet that very wealth fund, popularly known as the oil fund, has become a headache for politicians too. In recent months, it has emerged that the fund has invested in and made considerable gains from several Israeli firms that have directly contributed to the war in Gaza. After considerable public and political pressure, the fund has divested from 11 Israeli companies so far, in turn creating diplomatic tensions with Israel and its supporters, like the USA. The Socialist Left Party, essential to a future Labour coalition, wants the fund to divest fully from Israel, yet Labour has resisted a complete withdrawal from investments there, and that is something parties on the right agree with. So, who's going to win come Monday night? Just under a year ago, nobody thought Prime Minister Jonas Gahr Støre from the Labour Party would manage to be re-elected. He was trailing Conservative opposition leader Erna Solberg by nearly 15% in popularity. But then two things happened. Labour's then coalition partner, the Agrarian Centre Party, left government because of deep disagreements over EU energy policy. This left Labour to run a minority government, yet it proved popular with traditional Labour voters and those on the fence. The Centre Party had held the finance minister position, and their departure allowed the PM to fill the vacancy with near universally popular Jens Stoltenberg, the former NATO Secretary General and also a former PM. The Labour Party is currently polling near 28%, and with support from the Socialist Left and the Greens, Prime Minister Jonas Gahr Støre might just secure a second term. Not that it would be easy. Not only do the smaller parties want to see action over Israeli investments and increases in the wealth tax, they also want to phase out the very source of Norway's wealth, oil and gas, far earlier than Labour, which wants to continue petroleum operations beyond 2050. Lars Bevanger, DW.
Before I sign off, I'd like to put in a quick word for our partners over at the World Programme from GBH and PRX. Despite increasingly difficult conditions for publicly funded radio in the US, they continue to cover a fantastic array of stories from around the globe. This week, for example, Jerry Haddon reported from Barcelona on the launch of the global Sumud flotilla to Gaza, and future shows are expected to feature updates from one of the ships. You'll find The World wherever you get your podcasts. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We're with The World, Public Radio's leading global news program.
We cover the biggest news events developing every day and give you the context you need to make sense of them.
And Carolyn, I also like our smaller stories, tales of discovery and human kindness, things that make us laugh.
Stories that kind of shrink our world and make us feel more connected.
Subscribe and listen every weekday to The World.
On Living Planet, we've got questions.
Is anyone trying to clean up this mess?
Big questions. Should we really be sinking our money into this?
Questions that get to the bottom of things.
How much CO2 does a tree absorb anyway? Your questions.
How often do you think we should use the reusable cups to compensate for the paper ones?
But don't worry, we've got answers too. Answers to help you navigate some of the biggest environmental issues of our time. That's On Living Planet.
Find us wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. Now, did you know that over one-fifth of the global ocean darkened between 2003 and 2022? It's the kind of fact that is almost guaranteed to make my mind freeze in terror. But luckily, my gloriously level-headed colleague Neil King from our sister podcast Living Planet has been taking a thorough look at the phenomenon, what it is, what it means, and what can be done about it. The reporting is all centred on the Baltic Sea, so this seems like an Inside Europe story as well, albeit an unusually watery one. So, with kind permission of the Living Planet team, here is their investigation titled, Why Are Oceans Getting Darker?
Ocean darkening, and specifically coastal ocean darkening, refers to how much light gets into the depths of the ocean to a plant or a fish sitting at the bottom of the ocean. It refers to the light within the ocean itself, not as seen from above. From a bird's eye view, an ocean surface can shine brightly and yet be very dark under the water.
Der heller von oben erscheint, der kann unten sehr dunkel sein.
Oliver Zielinski is the director of the Leibniz Institute for Baltic Sea Research. He has studied the darkening in the Baltic Sea and North Sea for years. However, the problem is a global one. According to researchers, the darkening is happening in the waters around New Zealand, the US, Singapore, China, Japan, and in the Mediterranean Sea.
Ja, da gibt es diese Trends und da sehen wir die.
That's where we measured darkening of coastal waters. This is where we have long series of measurements and where human interaction with the ocean has been strong.
Menschliche Interaktion mit dem Ozean stark der Fall war.
Human interaction with the ocean. We'll save this little bit of what Zielinski just said for later when we talk about what or who causes the darkening. Before that, we're taking a little walk with Zielinski to the harbour quay. He wants to show us something, a tool.
Ich lasse jetzt die Säckischeibe runter ins Wasser.
I'm now lowering the disc into the water and watching it slowly drift down from the surface.
The disc that Zielinski puts in the water is a Secchi disc, named after its inventor, Pietro Angelo Secchi, a 19th century priest and scientist in Italy. It is white and 30 centimeters in diameter, a bit like a large pizza plate on a cord. Zielinski is holding the cord with both hands, letting the disc sink down centimeter by centimeter into the water just off the quay.
Jetzt kann man ja sehen, dass die Säckscheibe immer schlechter zu sehen ist.
It is getting harder to see the disc now as the murky water covers it. The important thing is that I now figure out the exact depth at which I can hardly see the disc. If I lift it up a little now, I can see the disc again. That's it. And that is the depth I'll write down.
Diese Tiefe, die notiere ich mir.
The disc is roughly 2.5 meters under the sea surface. And according to Zielinski, light, as a rule of thumb, reaches down into the water three times as deep. That's 7.5 meters then. That sounds pretty deep, actually, but it used to be much more. Since 1900, the depth of visibility, or Secchi depth, on the coasts of the Baltic Sea and North Sea has decreased by 3 to 4 centimeters per year. The question is, why did this happen?
Aber das Wasser selbst hat sich natürlich nicht über die letzten 100 Jahre geändert. The water itself obviously didn't change over the past 100 years. So it's the substances that got into the water, three of them, algae, dissolved matter, and sediments.
Dritter Faktor sind Sedimente.
Okay, so here is what we've got so far. Coastal waters around the globe have been getting darker for decades, meaning that the depth to which light can reach into the water has decreased. And that's because of algae, dissolved matter and sediments. Let's explore what that exactly means and what harm it does. We're in a speedboat, heading out to a lagoon in the Baltic Sea, east of Stralsund. We're not here on our own, of course.
Ich bin Florian Hoffmann, bin Biologe.
I am Florian Hoffmann. I'm a biologist, and I've been working with the World Wildlife Fund in Stralsund for 10 years.
WWF-Büro in Stralsund.
Florian has kindly agreed to take us out for a diving trip. We arrive at the lagoon. But if you're thinking crystal clear turquoise water now, well, you won't find that here. Quite the opposite. But that's why we're here, after all. We drop anchor near a small island, where many plants are supposed to grow on the seabed, like seaweed or crested pondweed, green and lush. The water is not that deep, only 2.5 meters, as the echo sounder on board indicates. You don't need big diving gear for this depth. We're already dressed with a wetsuit. Now it's time for the flippers and the belt with heavy weights.
I'll start with two weights. I'll go down and then tell you how much to take with you, because this wetsuit leads to a little buoyancy.
Time to spit on the diving goggles. Rub the spittle so that the goggles don't fog up, adjust the mouthpiece off the snorkel, and we're ready to go. Hoffmann jumps first.
Visibility is terrible.
Let's go take a look for ourselves. The seabed is just a few strong poles away. Gliding above it, we can only see about an arm's length. Beyond that, it gets dark. Not dark in the sense of black, of course. We are in shallow water, after all. More like a fog. A dense and murky mixture of brown and green. What we can see directly in front of us are patches of sand, and then again patches of seaweed and other plants. Their stalks seem to pop up out of nowhere and sweep across our arms and face. To be honest, it's a bit of a confusing and uncomfortable environment at first. But after gaining some orientation, much of the murkiness seems to come from masses of small green particles. They float around in the water weightlessly, like artificial snow in one of those kitschy snow globes. Back on the boat, Florian Hoffmann explains what we just saw. The green particles, he says, that's phytoplankton, the basis of all life in the seas, and producer of half the oxygen we breathe. So having phytoplankton in the seas is essential. But when there's too much of it, it makes the water foggy, as it dies and slowly sinks to the ground.
Das heißt, die Sichttiefe nimmt ab.
This means that the light zone decreases. We know from older literature that the depths to which you could look down into the water here used to be up to 8 meters. It has now decreased to 3 or 2 meters, and that, of course, makes it a lot harder for sea plants to grow on the seabed here.
Hoffmann has pulled out a handful of seaweed and brought it back on board. Some of the stalks are covered with small brown stains. The remains of phytoplankton shield the living plants from light, even in death. The reason for this mess in the water lies on land, Hoffmann says. When farmers spread too much fertilizer on their fields, it doesn't only make the crops grow.
Was ist Eutrophierung? Ist eine Überdüngung. Ist die erhöhte Versorgung von Gewässern mit Pflanzennährstoffen.
That overuse of fertilizer leads to increased supply of water bodies with nutrients. That's nitrogen, which is important for photosynthesis, and phosphorus, a component of the DNA, which is also an important building block for life.
Florian Hoffmann has brought a clipboard with him, with sheets of paper, showing charts and numbers.
Das ist jetzt hier vom BMU von 2018.
So these are figures from the Federal Ministry of Environment from 2021. Agriculture accounted for 78% of nitrogen inputs in the Baltic Sea and 51% of phosphorus inputs, while point sources such as sewage treatment plants accounted for another 10% of nitrogen inputs and 20% of phosphorus inputs.
Apart from these nutrients and water, of course, it's light that makes photosynthesis possible and lets plants grow. Imagine if someone switched off the sun. How long would life on Earth survive? The trees, the bushes, insects, birds, mammals, all life. This is a dark thought experiment. But looking at the foggy water underneath our boat, out there on the lagoon, the threat seems real enough. If the seaweed doesn't get enough light, it dies. Like here in the lagoon. Spanning more than 500 square kilometres, there used to be a giant underwater seaweed lawn here, just 70 years ago. Today the plants have retreated to the shallow edges of the lagoon. This has effects on the whole food chain in the water and beyond. Small fish that are at the start of the chain use seaweed to hide and to spawn. In this part of the Baltic Sea, it's the herring that essentially depends on it as it lays its spawn in the seaweed. The herring population has massively collapsed over the last 10 years. In an unfavourable combination, the fish migrated to the lagoon earlier due to warmer waters, but then failed to find sufficient seaweed there. The problem with that is that the herring is at the beginning of the local marine food web. Less herring means less food for bigger fish, ducks, seals. And less catch for fisherman Klaas Wollner, whom we heard at the beginning of this episode.
Das hatten wir schon schlechter.
Healthy seaweed is also a real climate superhero. 1 square kilometre of seaweed captures twice as much CO2 as terrestrial forest, and it does this 35 times faster as well. The same goes for other plants in coastal waters. Researchers in New Zealand looked at the health of kelp in a lagoon that had strong inflow of nutrients from agriculture and the city of Auckland. They found that the darkening in that lagoon caused local kelp forests to degrade and fix up to 4.7 times less carbon than they usually would. To mention it a bit in advance, we're not doomed because of coastal ocean darkening. That being said, though, our takeaway from the diving trip with Florian Hoffmann is that coastal ocean darkening does both harm biodiversity and the climate. But there is one life form that seems to handle the dark waters quite well. As Hoffmann speaks, a handful of common jellyfish float past the boat, just a little below the sea surface. Jellyfish, who consist of 95% water, are particularly transparent and small, about the size of a saucer. They have a distinct advantage in the murky water.
Jellyfish don't need light to feed. It's a so-called tactile predator.
That's Dag Aksnes.
Yes, I'm a marine ecologist at the University of Bergen, and I have studied mostly fjords, but also the ocean.
You've likely seen pictures of Norway's majestic fjords, long and narrow, placed between steep cliffs and several hundred meters deep. At first glance, the fjords appear to be lakes, but they are in fact saltwater inlets from the North Sea, mixed with some freshwater from land that gets into the fjords via mighty waterfalls. But we're moving away from the topic. After decades of research, Dag Aksnes has come to know the fjords around Bergen like the back of his hand, both above and below the waterline. But one day, he and his colleagues from the University of Bergen went to a fjord called Lurefjord to check up on the fish population there. They let the trawl net down into the water, started the boat's engine, and set off.
We would expect, like, at maximum in half an hour to get like 100 kilogram of this mesoplank fish, which is very abundant also. But when we trawl in this fjord, then we actually have to cut the trawl in the water and destroy it because we couldn't have it up on deck.
Instead of a bit of fish, and after just a few minutes, the trawl net is bursting with thousands of big orange fluorescent jellyfish.
So you can trawl them, and actually in 5 minutes you can have 5 ton. So it's a ton per minute.
The helmet jellyfish is found all over the world, and that's perfectly normal, but not in such large numbers. For the whole fjord, Axnes estimates the population of jellyfish at 50,000 tons, or in individuals...
Oh, well, if you say 500 gram each, so yeah, then you will have like in a ton, you will have 2,000, and then you have 50,000 tons. So yeah, 50,000 multiplied with 2,000, yeah.
Which translates into 100 million jellyfish, but almost no other life.
And then we start wondering, why is this jellyfish here and not the fishes? And then we saw that the water down there was very dark.
Too dark for visual hunting fish to see its prey. Meanwhile, jellyfish don't need light, but use their tentacles to sense prey. Less competition and warmer seas due to climate change help them to spread. Not only in the Lurefjord, which is now also known as the Jellyfish Fjord, but to a smaller extent also in many other fjords along the Norwegian coast. But the reason for the dark water in the fjords is different from the nutrient overflow in the Baltic Sea.
So actually we got a very extended water column with coastal water containing lots of dissolved organic matter, which originates from land. And the next question, of course, which we still investigate, is why has this amount of dissolved organic matter, which absorbs light, increased?
Dissolved organic matter. Small particles of rotten leaves or wood. It gets into the Norwegian fjords via the rivers from all over northern Europe and stays in there for decades before it eventually degrades. In the case of the Lurefjord, it accumulates more and more due to an exceptionally narrow exit to the sea. The irony here is that the source of all this organic matter is something that we'd usually desire. More nature.
The evidence now is that this is because of increased greening in the northern Europe. There are more trees now than 100 years ago, much more. This is partly because of changed land use. The other reason, I believe, is warming and also increased precipitation over the northern Europe, which also stimulates greening, of course. More green coverage in Scandinavian and northern Europe, which produces more dissolved organic matter that enters the sea sooner or later.
Think of it as a cup of tea. You pour in the water, add a tea bag, and watch as the water slowly turns brown. And now think of that cup of tea as a big barrel standing in a garage building, named like a character from a Transformers movie, Planktotron. We're at the Institute for Chemistry and Biology of the Marine Environment in Wilhelmshaven. That's another German harbour town, the last one, that's a promise. But this one is situated at the North Sea coast. The planktotrons are 12 large cylindrical tanks made from stainless steel and wrapped with hemp and black foil for insulation. The numbers 1 to 12 are taped on the foil with pink duct tape.
Also, wir können in einem kleineren, auf kleineren it's calm.
We can simulate the marine environment on a smaller scale here. We can put 600 litres of seawater or lake water in each planktotron and then either recreate the same conditions as outside in the seas or manipulate the conditions. For example, we can increase water temperature. We can manipulate nutrients, or what we did in the Coastal Ocean Darkening project was to manipulate the light.
Wir in Coastal Ocean Darkening genutzt haben, war halt das Licht zu manipulieren.
Maren Striebel is a biologist at the Institute. She does research on plankton and was part of the research group of Oliver Zielinski, whom we heard earlier. Striebel used the planktotrons to cross-check and add to the research results from the analysis of the long record of Secchi disk measurements and new measurements with satellites and deep-diving autonomous sensors.
Das können wir entweder über die Lichter, die oben angebracht sind.
We could do this with lights at the top of the planktotron, but mostly we were interested in the organic material. For example, the coloured material that can be washed from the land into the seas. So we added a peat extract to the water, which caused a brown coloration and also brought some nutrients into the water.
Zum anderen aber halt auch zum Beispiel Nährstoffe mit reinbringt.
Nutrients and organic matter. The two drivers of coastal ocean darkening that we have already looked at in this episode. Striebel moves a small ladder up to one of the planktotrons. She has filled it with tap water and switched on the power to show how it works. Through a thick pane of glass, we can see a paddle slowly rotating around an axis in the middle. It keeps the water moving and uses a silicone lip to wipe the inside wall of the barrel to prevent vegetation growth. Valves are built into the wall to be able to take water samples and measure values such as oxygen concentration or temperature. On top of all that, strong LED lights simulate daylight with different intensities. In her 5-week experiment on coastal ocean darkening in 2017, biologist Striebel filled the planktotrons with water from the North Sea. Which means that she also had to simulate the tides. She used pumps and hoses to create a cycle with rain barrels of the same size.
Also wir hatten drei verschiedene Stufen, Intensitäten an Eintrag von diesem organischen Material.
We had three different levels of intensity of input of dissolved organic matter. There was definitely shading at the beginning and an impact on the primary producers, the phytoplankton. We observed a reduction in its biomass, which had an impact on the next trophical stage, for example, the food web in the water. But then the organic matter degraded over time and the nutrients were used up. So the system returned to its original state at some point.
The dissolved organic matter was eaten up by organisms in the water, which subsequently cleared and brightened up. That's good news. But in another experiment, Striebel and her colleagues also added sediment to the water in the planktotrons, or sand, taken from the local beach. And sand doesn't get used up by organisms because it doesn't have any useful nutrients. So the sand stays in the water. Again, think of it as a cup or glass. This time, you add a teaspoon of sand and give it a good stir. The water turns murky for some time before the sand slowly settles at the bottom of the glass. But the seas are no glass of water, and the sediment in it is more than a teaspoon. Here's Oliver Zielinski again.
Stürme befördern mehr Sedimente ins Wasser und trüben das Wasser, das Licht kann weniger eindringen.
Storms carry more sediments into the water and make the water murky. We will have more storms as a result of climate change. But we also have more sediments in the water because we have coastal erosion due to coastlines and construction work in the water. Trawlers stir up the sea ground with their heavy nets. All these things mobilize sediments and make the water cloudy. So the effect of sediment for visibility in the water is very strong.
Also der Effekt von Sedimenten auf die optische Transparenz und auf die Farbe ist sehr stark.
We'll be right back after this message.
Ati ABTN News presents a captivating journey into the heart of the North with our latest podcast, The Place That Thaws. The podcast is a unique exploration of the North, delving deep into the environmental challenges confronting the high Arctic.
Some areas that used to be safe are no longer safe.
Aoyuituk, the place that never thaws. Except that now, it is thawing. Hosted by me, Danielle Parody. Join us as we uncover the intricacies of life on a changing coast. Experience the Arctic like never before. Subscribe and listen to The Place That Thaws, brought to you by APTN.
Nature's trick to keep sediment on the seabed is vegetation, like seaweed. It stabilizes the ground with its roots. If the seaweed retreats because of too little light, the seabed becomes even more unstable and the water even murkier. It's a vicious cycle, if you like.
I rather like to tell science in positive narratives. If we manage to grow seaweed again, this will also bind sediment. The water will become clearer, and we may be able to go deeper to establish even more seaweed.
Speaking of positive narratives, Oliver Zielinski hardly complains as we talk. He has every reason to do so, though, doesn't he? I mean, people are worried about plastic in the seas or coral bleaching, but darkening water isn't getting that kind of attention. His optimism comes from the fact that darkening is already stagnating in the Baltic Sea in particular, but also in the Mediterranean and North America. In the North Sea, the water has even been brightening again since the 1980s. Thanks to regulations around fertilizer use and the ban of phosphate in washing detergents, less nutrients have been entering the North Sea. But with global warming, rainfall and storms will become more extreme, which will lead to more organic matter and sediment being washed into coastal waters, Zielinski says. The best way to stop coastal ocean darkening would therefore be to limit global warming.
Measures are being taken, but the efforts need to be increased. They actually need to be doubled because climate change is working against us. We have to make an even greater effort to get back to the situation we had in the coastal waters before.
That's the big picture. Back in the harbour, marine biologist Florian Hoffmann thinks that very specific local action is needed too.
Well, trying to use less fertilizer and specifically for what you need, and possibly trying to keep water in the landscape after it rains, not pumping it directly into the sea, but letting it flow through a reed bed area where the washed away nutrients can separate.
You've been listening to A Living Planet Investigation, researched and written by Jonas Meyer. The sound engineer was Thomas Schmidt, and it was narrated and edited by Neil King. Neil, by the way, recently let slip to me that an average episode of Living Planet features about 30 different sound effects and 10 different music tracks, at which point, suitably humbled, I exited the conversation. Back in the Inside Europe studio, it is time to wrap up for the week. The programme was produced by me, Kate Laycock, and our sound engineer was Michael Springer. Extra support from Navina Boot. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.